Well, thank you very much, John, and thank you to the organisers for the invitation to be here. It was indeed a professional highlight for me to be a visiting scholar here nearly 25 years ago. It's frightening how long that is ago, but it was a great time, and it's a pleasure indeed to return here to San Francisco to take part in this symposium on Asian banking and finance. I think it's apt that the symposium should focus on some of the regulatory challenges that we're all collectively seeking to deal with in the wake of the crisis of 2007 and 2008. And it's particularly welcome that it gives voice to partners from the Asian time zone. And in fact, looking to Asia is something that's been a hallmark of the San Francisco Fed for a very long time, and for which we commend you. More than ever, finance has been global over the past couple of decades, and that's brought many benefits, but also certain vulnerabilities, as we've all found. It's brought challenges for the regulatory community, and there's a prodigious effort, and prodigious is certainly the word, underway to try to work together to produce a regulatory framework that's genuinely international. But the thing is, many of the responses to the crisis are, and I think will remain, national. As such, they're partly, at least, driven by the circumstances and the imperatives of the countries concerned. And nothing else could really be expected, but ensuring that all those national responses dovetail into a cohesive and coherent international framework, and one that preserves what's good about international finance, globalized finance, that's no small order. Moreover, the economic and financial importance of Asia is greater now than past times when we put regulatory standards together. So engaging Asia is very sensible. And to that end, the Financial Stability Board and various of the standard-setting bodies that attend the Financial Stability Board have adjusted their membership over the past several years in a way that recognises the importance of the Asian countries and indeed those of that of some other regions. It's nonetheless the case that in oftentimes the Asian members, and I think perhaps members from other parts of the emerging world, can't help but feel that the agenda is being driven by the major countries. Now, to the extent that those countries, the G7, say, are used to working together, and given that the crisis was really focused in the financial systems of that group of countries by and large, that's no great surprise. But while that historical cooperation is a platform to build on, and it's a very important one, it's nonetheless important that the system we build for the future looks forward, and when you do that, of course, it's important to see that the Asian time zone is where much of the growth in the world economy and in finance is going to come from. That said, I think it's also important for those of us who are in the Asian time zone, including my own country, to continue to strengthen our own capacity to engage effectively in the international groups to which we've now been given the privilege of membership. Let me talk then about some themes which are present in the regulatory agenda internationally. And I'm going to frame this under the banner of the G20, which is the body that has accepted or perhaps asserted high-level political oversight over these efforts. The Financial Stability Board is the body that's accepted the responsibility of trying to ensure that the efforts are coordinated across countries, respecting the integrity of the individual standard setters, most of which predate the FSB, but also being prepared to address risks itself where they might otherwise fall between the cracks. As you may know, Australia has the responsibility of the G20 presidency this year, and that's why I'm going to frame my remarks under that banner. We're highly supportive of the way the chair of the FSB has structured the efforts for this year around four key themes. What are they? increasing resilience of financial institutions, that's really Basel III in the main, reforming markets for derivatives, thirdly, addressing risks that come from shadow banking, so-called, and finally, addressing the problem of too big to fail, which is probably the most intractable of the four themes that I've mentioned. Now, the fact that we're highlighting these things doesn't mean that other things are forgotten, but it is an attempt to prioritise, to focus our energies and to use the opportunity of the Leaders' Summit, which is in Brisbane, Australia, in November, as a focal point to try to get some things across the line this year. So I'd like to make a few remarks on each of those four themes. Basel III, well, that's well on track. Most countries are well placed to implement this in line with the agreed timetables. Remaining policy details are being ironed out. We've recently finalised the leverage ratio requirement. There are further proposals on net stable funding to come. And the Basel Committee is continuing the work trying to pin down the reasons for the excessive variation in the way risk-weighted assets are measured across jurisdictions. On the question of capital standards, just to diverge briefly on that, it's frequently claimed that pressing major banks to hold more capital will impair growth. Well, I think there are two things to say about that argument. The first is, if you have a situation of acute deficiency of capital, as we've seen in some jurisdictions in the past 5 years, it's best to address that quickly. If you consider just the contrast between the US and Europe, this is very clear. In 2009, the Fed conducted a public stress test of US banks and insisted that where those tests reveal weaknesses, that the banks strengthen their capital positions quickly. They could do that. They could carry out that exercise because they had a backstop capital delivery mechanism in the form of public injections of capital if needed. And so these two things were mutually reinforcing for confidence. You could do the stress test, the capital could come from the market or if not, from the government. It's taken a lot longer to get to that position in Europe. There were stress tests in earlier years, but they don't seem to have had full credibility in the eyes of the markets. Moreover, Europe didn't have a Europe-wide public capital injection device, and so it was left to individual governments to inject capital if needed. And I think it's apparent that whereas American banks carried out balance sheet repair early and have for some time been in a position to fund or help to fund the growth of the US economy, European banks in aggregate have continued to deleverage over that period. And that can't have been good for Europe's growth. That's being rectified. The ECB will publish their asset quality review later this year, and I expect that would be a very credible exercise. Europe's in the process of building the single supervisory mechanism, and over a time, admittedly a rather long time, they're committed to building a single resolution capability and a Europe-wide capacity for injecting capital. They're all very important steps, but I think this US-Europe comparison shows that prompt efforts to fix serious problems of capital deficiency are ultimately progress, not anti-growth. Well, that's if you're in a crisis. What about in more stable times? Can banks with more capital support growth as well as banks with less? Well, equity is more expensive than debt, and so a financial structure with more equity does mean, other things equal, the cost of intermediation to the community will be higher. Even without appealing to propositions of a Modigliani-Miller kind, which would dispute that assertion, the question then really is whether that apparently higher cost to intermediation is a serious impediment to growth. Now, many bankers would say it is. On the other hand, the empirical estimates based on research put out by the FSB and the Basel Committee suggest the effect is small, particularly if you compare that effect with the cost of large financial crises. So there's a debate there, but I think if you step back from that debate, and this is really my second point about this question, we might reflect on the following question, and that is whether the highly leveraged expansion of some parts of the financial system pre the crisis really added that much sustainably to growth? I think it's far from obvious that it did. It seems to me actually more likely that it was the other way around. I think it's more likely that a period of good and pretty stable growth, the Great Moderation so-called, itself led to a rise in leverage. The reasons for that growth stability, I don't think they were mainly in the financial system. Nonetheless, people concluded that that lower volatility made higher leverage safe. And so they acted on that piece of analysis and geared up. In the process, inadvertently sowing the seeds of future instability, because leverage balance sheets, of course, left borrowers and lenders more exposed when some adverse shock came along. So the feedback effects from growth to balance sheets, or from the lack of growth to balance sheets, I think is a very powerful phenomenon. Maybe the big question isn't whether more demanding capital standards will impair growth. Maybe the big question is, what will growth or the lack of growth do to banks' capital positions? It's noteworthy in this context that the phase-in for the Basel III standards goes all the way out to 2019. You have to ask, I think, how likely is it that we will go another 5 years without a downturn in the economy of some kind? Even if we do, even if we assume that, say, the US expansion, which has been going since 2009, Europe, let's date that from 2013, last year, even if they keep going all the way till 2019, they'll be fairly mature expansions by then. So you would hope that by 2019, when we're supposed to have put Basel III fully in place, major financial institutions would not only have reached new international minima for capital, but would in fact have risen above those minima by then, because that would be the peak of the cycle. You'd hope that balance sheets by that time would be at their strongest, not just at the minimum. That, I think, is a reason to go faster rather than slower, if you can, in accumulating capital. And that observation, I'd have to say, is of some relevance to some debates that are ongoing in my own country right now. So that's Basel III and capital. On the question of derivatives, we've got efforts to achieve more reporting, more platform trading, and more central clearing. In the main, these things are running behind the original schedules. And the reason for that is this is highly complex. To craft mutually consistent rules across jurisdictions is difficult in a market which is highly globalized. It has to be said that regulations in the major jurisdictions, by which I mean the US and Europe, have very considerable extraterritorial effects. So it's critical that there be a high degree of consistency if we're to avoid fragmentation and the cost that comes with that. The smaller jurisdictions like my own feel this very acutely, but actually this isn't just a concern for small jurisdictions. Even large jurisdictions would bear costs from unnecessary fragmentation. To avoid that, what we need is a good understanding across jurisdictions of each other's regulatory arrangements and of the areas in which we can give mutual recognition to each other's arrangements. But to do that, it takes more than just verbal commitment. It requires the building of confidence that the enforcement of other people's rules, which have the same intent as your own but slightly different words, will in fact produce broadly the same outcomes. Now, it takes time to establish that confidence, and that, I think, is one of the reasons why this process is running behind time. Nonetheless, some progress is being achieved, including, importantly, between the US and Europe, and that's very important. It's also, I think, to be recognised that both the Europeans and the Americans have put a lot of effort into assessing for mutual compatibility the regulatory arrangements of a number of other smaller jurisdictions, and that's no small task, and so we acknowledge that. But I think we have a way to go yet. Progress could be improved if relevant international standards, rather than some other standard, was the benchmark for assessment of regulatory equivalence, and if regulators could communicate the basis of their decisions and provide certainty by clarifying the scope for transitional relief where that's appropriate in a timely manner. Thirdly, to shadow banking. Well, here there have been considerable efforts by the FSB and the standard setters to address the various risks. And shadow banks, in essence, are those entities that are beyond the regulatory, the usual regulatory perimeter. The crisis showed that that sector can be a source of systemic risk, especially in jurisdictions, and the US would be the main one, where shadow banks are a large proportion of overall funding. We also have to be alert to a build-up in shadow banking risk that could occur as we tighten the regulation inside the regulatory perimeter and cause some activities to migrate outside it. We do, however, need to strike a balance here. Firstly, the number of jurisdictions where this is likely to be a big problem is relatively small, and we don't want efforts to contain shadow banking unduly and unnecessarily to stifle genuinely productive innovation and intermediation. So the FSB, IOSCO and the Basel Committee are working on addressing risks in several areas here, including money market funds, securitisation markets, banks' links with shadow banks and securities financing transactions. Broad policy frameworks have been finalised in these areas, with work ongoing in relation to securities financing transactions. It's important, I think, and it remains important, to retain some degree of flexibility in the recommendations here, given that in some countries, quite a number of countries actually, shadow banking markets are relatively small, and in those cases they won't be a source of systemic risk. Let me turn then to Too Big to Fail, which, as I said earlier, is, I think, arguably the most intractable, potentially, of the various problems we face. One of the key issues here this year is to put forward a proposal for gone concern loss absorbing capacity, or so-called GLAC, for systemically important banks, GSIBs. And the idea is that even though additional capital under Basel III makes failure more likely, and even though for systemic banks there's a surcharge on top of that which makes it even less likely, it's still not impossible that a GSIB could fail. And these sort of entities are sufficiently large and interconnected that an uncontrolled failure could cause systemic, or very likely would cause systemic disruption. So it's argued that further loss-absorbing capacity on top of Basel III and on top of the GSIB surcharge is appropriate to be called on at the point of non-viability, so as to allow vital functions to continue and to allow non-critical operations of such entities to be wound down in an orderly fashion. That would limit adverse spillovers to the financial system and therefore to the economy. Generally, that loss-absorbing capacity is supposed to come from so-called bail-in of certain classes of private creditors in order to avoid having to have a bail-out by the taxpayer. Well, that's an appealing idea and an important one. It does, I think, come with the caveat that, as far as I know anyway, I'm not aware of a successful resolution entirely using private bail-in that's been carried out so far for a large institution. So could happen, but it hasn't yet been successfully done. There are a few important issues to resolve in the process of crafting a proposal. Amongst those are the questions of what instruments count towards GLAC, how much GLAC you need, and what measures should be taken to mitigate the risks of contagion of these instruments across the system. Well, on what should count, a key question is whether equity capital above the regulatory minimum should count or not. And there are two views here. The view against counting that excess equity is essentially, I think, that in a stress situation, there's a great deal of uncertainty about how much equity is actually there. In a stress scenario, historically one tends to find that you wake up one day and actually the shareholders' funds are much smaller than had been previously thought. That problem of illusory capital, certainly not unknown in the annals of crisis management. The alternative view, which I think is more widely held, is that not to count excess equity towards GLAC acts as a disincentive on banks to hold excess capital in the form of equity. And that's not good because from a risk perspective, higher equity is almost always better to have than not have. That view is held very strongly in Asia, where banks in a number of countries tend to have quite high levels of equity capital. So they're the two views. I can myself come down on the side of counting excess equity, at least to a point. I think the more serious, genuine shareholder capital a bank has, the more likely it remains a going concern rather than a gone one. And so you don't get to the point of needing to bail in the other creditors and resolve the institution. You'd still be doing some kind of recapitalisation in a stress scenario. But I'd rather do a recapitalisation of a going concern than resolve a gone concern one. I think you'd have to have a lot of confidence in your resolution framework not to prefer a G-SIB that had a lot more equity with which you could work to help it recover than to assume you can bail in all the private creditors in a resolution situation. That's my own view anyway. Of course, there still could be a tail event big enough to exhaust even higher levels of equity and therefore require a resolution. And we might be uncomfortable about how quickly we burn through the equity in a crisis situation. And we do want to be sure that we can resolve a G-SIB. So some debt-type GLAC may well be helpful in that situation. Unless we had really draconian standards for equity capital, some requirement for bail-in debt in addition to the equity may well be sensible. But as I say, I think it's appropriate to allow equity capital that's in excess of regulatory minima to count at least a fair bit of the way towards the GLAC requirements. Another important consideration here would be to mitigate the risk that imposing losses on some holders of GLAC destabilises the system. So you wouldn't want one G-SIB to hold the GLAC of another, for example. Or if they did, you'd want to have some discounting out of capital to reflect that. There needs to be clear subordination of the relevant liabilities so that the creditors are not uncertain when the event comes. There needs, as I say, to be limitations on cross-holdings of GLAC-type obligations, and there would probably need to be limits on terms, maturity of GLAC liabilities, so that they're not all about to mature in the next few months and then they can't be rolled over, and then that buffer isn't really there. So all those things are important considerations. All of those things are being debated quite actively now, and the intent is to put a proposal, a concrete proposal, to the G20 leaders in Brisbane in November, and then to have that to go to public consultation, quantitative impact study, and so on subsequently. A couple of other elements on too big to fail, just briefly. This comes really under the banner of international cooperation. The resolution of a G-SIB, if we ever have to do that, by definition, that's a cross-border event, and so we need strong arrangements for international cooperation. Agreements which recognise the rights and obligations both of home and host jurisdictions will be important here. Setting those out is also running behind time. These things, as usual, are complex. And one of the hurdles here is that there are impediments at a statutory level for information sharing across countries. So it's things like that need to be rectified. Recognition of resolution actions taken in another country in respect of the G-SIB will probably involve stays of various kinds. that will also be key, and that will require, in some jurisdictions, legislation, among other things. Legislatures also need to make sure that relevant regulators have a mandate and a capability effectively to cooperate and share information with their counterparts from other countries, and the legal tools to take part in the relevant resolution actions. So that's quite a big work stream to deal with a very big issue. So there's some observations about regulation. What I'd like to do to finish is just contemplate the question of limits to regulation. It's to be emphasised that everything I've talked about up to now is not so much new regulation, it's the fulfilment of commitments that were made some time ago, actually, to put in place regulatory reform. But what about beyond that? In particular, at what point does the agenda for better and, frankly, more regulation reach a natural conclusion? When does our focus shift from redesign of regulation under the duress of a crisis to focus more on operating the system in hopefully normal times, and at some point to evaluating how effective the strengthened regulations are turning out to be? I would imagine that that's a question the regulated institutions are asking. It's certainly one that is asked in the regulatory community as well. Well, central to addressing that question, I think, is to remember the big picture of what we're trying to do. And to put it very simply, we're applying the lessons learned during the crisis about the extent and the nature of risk, about the set of incentives that allowed it to build up, about the channels for contagion once the extent of risk and distress became apparent, and about the weaknesses in our collective capacity to manage a crisis once one occurred. Now, that doesn't equate to a desire to eliminate all risk. In fact, frankly, risk-taking is good. It's how society advances. A problem right now, arguably, is there's not enough risk-taking occurring. The kind of risk-taking of genuine entrepreneurial businesses, that's what I'm talking about. If you look at the level of capital spending in many advanced countries, there's not enough risk-taking happening right now. That's a different thing from saying there's not enough financial sector risk-taking. Plenty of people argue there's too much of that right now. But I think I would argue that in the so-called real economy, there's, in many countries at least, not quite enough risk-taking to occur occurring right now. So the idea isn't to eliminate all risk-taking at all. We do need, though, in the financial system, to recognise the risk and be clear about who bears it. The standard capital requirements on banks are about ensuring shareholders accept the risk run by the firm they own. And with an appropriate capital structure, those shareholders should be able to expect a reasonable risk-adjusted return. Remembering, of course, that banking is the ultimate leverage business, and so when things go sour, as they do sometimes, the shareholders' returns can quickly become negative and quite a large negative. With additional loss absorbencies for G-SIBs, we're asking shareholders in those cases to internalise the externalities that these very large and complex firms create for the system in the event of a failure. And with the GLAC requirements, what we're asking is for some of the other creditors to understand the risk that they may, in the case of a truly exceptional event, in effect become equity holders in a bank as part of a resolution. So that's all good. It's very important. But the risk funding cost curve isn't linear, at least I don't think it is, and certainly not over its entire length. At some point, requiring more and more loss absorbency to be provided by the private sector will come at an increasingly steep price. There must be events, at least conceptually, sufficiently far into the tails of the relevant distributions that no private balance sheet can be expected ex ante to bear the associated loss no matter what the price. Should such an event occur, policymakers will still be faced with the very delicate task of deciding whether or not to support such an institution or close it. So the policy task, in my view, isn't one of ensuring the probability of that event is absolutely zero, because I don't think you can. The task is about making that probability acceptably low at an acceptable price. And most particularly, we need to prevent a recurrence of a situation in which outcomes which were actually not that far into the tails of the distribution at all left the system in need of a public rescue. That's the thing we don't want to repeat. It equally follows, I think, that we're not trying to extend, and we shouldn't be trying to extend, the regulatory perimeter, so-called, indefinitely. There'll always be some risky activity around the fringes of the system, and that's fine. That's actually appropriate. Those who seek high returns and are prepared to accept that risk should be allowed to get on and do that. And there is, I think, some value in having that occur. The proviso is that as well as allowing those people to accept the rewards of the risk they take, we have to also be able safely to let them wear the losses. We can't have significant spillovers back into the core parts of the system which are publicly underwritten. And we can't have spillovers which impair the day-to-day function of the economy. So where those spillovers do look like they would exist, we need rules to isolate the risk-taking activities and actually keep them on the fringe where they can be allowed to keel over, to fail if that's what happens, without crashing the core system. So this actually, I think, leads me to what I think will be probably the greatest regulatory challenge for the future, and that is assessing when an activity which is presently beyond the perimeter might be about to present a threat to stability. And I think devoting a lot of resources to ever greater refinements to the details of the regulatory structure inside the perimeter isn't going to help us do that. I think having the big things inside the perimeter about right should be good enough, and after that, we need to make sure we devote adequate resources to keeping a general weather eye on the broader questions beyond the area illuminated by our present lamppost, to use that analogy. When you think about the pace of technological change, it's probably not going to get easier to do this, actually. The possible rise of virtual currencies, or the potential for the distinction between regulated financial institutions and, say, telecoms or technology companies to blur, they're just two things. Those kinds of things may well pose significant challenges to us. And doubtless they won't be the only ones. But my concluding comment would be, facing those uncertainties, it will probably still pay dividends to do three things. To keep our antenna tuned for the nature of the promises that are being made by the various players, to keep an eye on the extent of leverage involved, and to keep an ear out for the frequency with which we hear the cry that this time is different. Well, thank you very much for your attention, and I wish you well in your deliberations. Thank you.